Hello, everybody. Welcome to a new episode of The Dissenter. I'm your host, Ricardo Lopes, and today I'm joined by Dr. Jonathan Crystal. He is professor of psychological and brain sciences at Indiana University in the US. His research focuses on developing animal models of cognition. His current work focuses on episodic memory, source memory, and prospective memory in rats. He has also developed rodent models to assess retrieval practice, working memory, and metacognition. He is currently the editor of Learning and Behavior, and he recently served as president of the Comparative Cognition Society. So, Dr. Crystal, thank you a lot for taking the time to come on the show.
Thanks. It's great to chat with you.
Okay, great. So, before we get into the more complicated stuff here related to memory, particularly in animal models, perhaps it would be better for you to first explain to us how you deal with memory and the systems of classification of memory that we have, because I guess that when people think about memory, the first two things that come to mind is that they divide memory into long-term and short-term memory, but then we also have some subtypes of memory like procedural memory, episodic memory, semantic memory, and so it's a bit complicated. So what's the best way to approach the classification of the different types of memory that we have?
So I'll give you my perspective on that. I'm interested particularly in developing novel animal models of memory, and we're especially interested in the types of memory that's impaired in human diseases. So the big disease of memory is Alzheimer's disease, and the most profound and debilitating aspect of Alzheimer's disease is a devastating loss in episodic memory. So episodic memory is your memory for your own personally experienced events. So someone who goes and visits their grandmother who's suffering from Alzheimer's disease, she wouldn't remember that you were visiting 2 weeks ago talking about all the interesting things going on in your life. Mm-hmm. And of course, that's very distressing. And so episodic memory is about things that happen to you in your personal experience. Probably the biggest distinction against that is semantic memory, which is your knowledge about facts about the world. And so, you know, I remember all sorts of things that I've learned in the past. You can ask me the capital of Portugal. And you know, if I have information like that, that would be a semantic memory. The main difference from a semantic memory that's just facts about the world relative to episodic memory is that episodic memory would be remembering how I came to know that information. And I have no episodic memory. I probably read it in a book, but I have no memory of that. Or maybe a teacher said it in a classroom. And so that's sort of the key distinction between episodic memory and semantic memory. From my perspective on testing ideas about, say, episodic memory in non-human animals is not so much to be concerned about all the different types of memory, but to take the whole collection, to propose that the animal has a whole assortment of capacities. It has long-term memory, it has short-term memory, it has working memory, it has executive function, it has associative learning, go down the list, all of those things. And you could take that as sort of a package and then add one more thing, the proposal that in addition to all of these things, they also have episodic memory. And that's sort of at the heart of how we go about testing novel models of memory in animals.
Mm-hmm. So when you talk about, for example, semantic memory, I guess that people, if they are exposed to the word semantic there, they would immediately associate it with language. And so they would think that it necessarily has to be encoded linguistically in the brain in some way, I guess. So is that the case, that in order for us to have a semantic memory, we have to encode it and retrieve it linguistically or not?
Right. So indeed, people would say that about many aspects of memory, not just the semantic, which of course focuses on an aspect of linguistics, but our episodic memories. If I wanted to know what happened in the last 2 weeks since a visit to a family member, all of our discussions in people involves linguistically mediated assessments. And of course, that's the tricks of the trade on testing these ideas in non-humans, is to adapt approaches that people have developed with people for non-human animals where language is not in the picture.
Mm-hmm. So I'm going to ask you how you study those types of memories in other animals. But before that, what is the relationship between memory and cognition? Because, I mean, I guess that we need memory at least to some extent to be able to have cognitive, or at least some cognitive mechanisms operating normally, because we have to be able to retrieve some information for them to work. But, I mean, is memory a component of cognition? Or
yes. So
memory, how does the relationship go there?
Yeah. Memory is definitely an aspect of cognition. Mm-hmm. The nice thing about testing memory in non-human animals as opposed to more varied cognitive processes is that if it's a memory approach, we get to choose what the inputs are. We present that to the subjects, and then we know what the right answer is because we presented those items. And so that helps a lot to constrain what the known inputs and expected outputs. But yeah, indeed, the idea is to propose psychological processes that would explain how the animal came to perform in their behavior the way that they did, and all of that is appealing to cognitive explanations.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so could you tell us about perhaps some experimental designs and studies that you do to really know if an animal model has a certain type of memory and how it works in it?
Yeah, so my perspective on developing animal models of episodic memory is an argument of converging lines of evidence. So it means instead, the answer to your question isn't, in my view, that there's one way to assess episodic memory in animals, and if they pass a test of that type, then we'll say they necessarily have episodic memory. And there are a lot of people who hold that view, particularly on what people refer to as what, where, and when memory. But my view is that any particular approach will have some pattern of strengths and weaknesses, and the way that we could really develop confidence that it is legitimately episodic memory in the animals is to test lots of different approaches. And if you have, we have about six or seven of these approaches. Always looking for the next one, and if they pass the test in all these different preparations, then it increases the confidence that it's episodic memory. But I'll give you an example. It's our latest approach, which we call the replay of episodic memories. So the idea about replaying episodic memories is this is something that people do. I've come home at the end of the day, and I was carrying groceries and my keys and my cell phone, and the phone rang, and so I went and answered the phone, and I probably left my keys in a place that I can't now find. And one of the strategies that people use their episodic memory for in everyday life is to replay the feed, to replay that sequence that, oh, the phone call came in when I was just entering the kitchen, so I might go to that place to look for the missing item. So how would we do that with non-humans? We can't ask them about what happened when they come home. Right. So for these experiments, we use odors. We use household spices. We have over 100 odors in the lab. We infuse them on plastic lids that can be put on top of a plastic cup. So this is like if you went to a restaurant and you were going to take some salsa to go with your order, you might put it in one of these little cups. That's where we buy them from. We're using these supplies. So the lids we put into a container with an odorant, with a household spice or oil, and that sort of charges up that little piece of plastic with the odor. Then we can present those odors in a big arena where the animal's free to walk around at its own pace, and whenever it is ready, it can come over and sniff the lid. And we set up arrangements where if they, I'll call it, kick off the lid, they just push it out of the way. They're not firmly attached, so they're not, there's no trick involved to get the lid off. If they displace the lid, and they've displaced what we consider to be the correct lid, then we can give them pellets of food in the cup below the lid. And so these are animals that haven't eaten their food yet in the day. They get food every day, but the testing is done before we give them the bulk of their daily amount of food. So they're hungry, and they can learn fairly complicated rules about how to get that food, the very small reward pellets that we give them in the arenas. So I'll give you an example of a complicated rule. We give them a list of items to remember. This is a list of odors. If we were doing this experiment with people, we might present a list of pictures on a computer screen. But rats are not very good with visual information. They're excellent with odors, and they're excellent with spatial cognition, which we use in a lot of our preparations as well. So we give them a list of items. It might be cardamom, turmeric, paprika, garlic, basil, candy popcorn. We have a whole list of these items, and we give them to them one at a time as a list of things for them to remember. After the list has ended, we take them and to a different place and we assess their memory. And a key part, it turns out, is that the animals have no way to know how long the list will be until we take them to this other context. So it's just a different arena. It has different features. They can see out of the room a little better or worse in the different contexts because of how we've designed it. They have different patterns. So one, for example, might have a bullseye pattern on the floor, another one might be all white, and another one might be black. So the animals know where they are. They readily figure that out. So the key point is that the list is of an unpredictable length. They don't know how many items they're going to get until we literally pick them up and move them to this other place. And we move them to one of two other places. In one place, they're confronted with a choice between two items that appeared in the list, and they have to choose the item that was in the second last position from the end of the list. This is the complicated rule. How do the animals figure this out? We give them lots of opportunity to learn this by trial and error. So when we move them to one distinctive context, they need to choose the second last item from the list and avoid a foil item that appeared somewhere else in the list. Then we also move them to yet another context where now they have to choose the fourth last item in the list. And again, they have to learn that by trial and error. After lots of training, we're patient. We wait a long time. All the animals learn these rules, that if you move them to the second last context, they choose the second last item at about better than 80% correct. And if you move them to the fourth last context, now they choose the fourth last item at a similar level of accuracy. Okay, so the proposal is that the animals can replay the feed of their episodic memories, that they remember all these different items, mm-hmm. cardamom, paprika, garlic, I can't remember them all, and that they remember them in the order in which they occurred. That ordinal part is a critical aspect of replaying episodic memories. I remember what I did this morning in my kitchen making breakfast, and I remember what I did in my office a little bit later in the morning. And I don't confuse those two because I have information about the order in which the events occurred and the context in which they occurred. Okay, so here we train them up for a long time, and we get to the point where all the animals can pick out the second last item correctly, and in another context, they can pick out the fourth last item. So this is a long, complicated experiment, and I'll just pause at this point and say that might be replaying episodic memory. That's one way you can solve this problem. Replay the feed, search from the end and find the second last item, search from the end and find the fourth last item. But they could also do it without episodic memory. And this is one of the challenges to make the case that the animals are really using episodic memory. We need to, this is what I was saying before, we have to have the proposal. They have all these different types of memory and that whole package plus one other, episodic memory. And if they could solve the rather complicated problems that we give them using any of those other capacities, then I'm not convinced that it's episodic memory. That's sort of our approach. So if you could bear with me, I'll describe a non-episodic memory solution to the same task. So every time we present an item, it gives rise to a memory trace that begins to decay over time, right? This is sort of an old view about representations of events. If I took a big, heavy textbook and I slammed it on the table, it's sort of feel the sound outlasting the movement of the book. That's your memory of the sound. Okay, so here's a problem. It takes only a little bit of time to go from the second last item to the test, just a little bit of decay. It takes, of course, longer to go from the fourth last item to the end of the list. We start with a big memory trace and it decays even more. So maybe the animals are just picking out not the second last or the fourth last in an ordinal sense, but the item that has the memory trace strength that just is the typical level for a second last item or the typical level for a fourth last item. The key point is they can get the answer right, but I wouldn't call that episodic memory, and I certainly wouldn't call it the replay of episodic memories. They would be merely judging the memory trace strength of the memories. And people often call that the familiarity. So, you know, to give you a sense of familiarity, I'm walking down the street and I see someone who's vaguely familiar to me, but it's a bit of an embarrassing situation. I don't remember all the details about when I met that person. And if it's the person who's sitting in the front row of my classroom, it's a little bit of an embarrassing situation if I don't remember, you know, who this person is and where I know them from. So that's a distinction between the full-blown episodic memory. Yeah, that's the person who asks lots of questions in the front of the classroom versus this more vague sense of familiarity that in some respects you have the sense that this is a face that you should remember, but you don't have the full-blown episodic memory. So this is the problem with the memory trace strength account. There's a non-episodic memory solution that we have this vague sense of familiarity, and we can even make rather refined judgments about the different levels of strength of those memories, and they can get the answers right in our experiment. So clearly that's a problem. The problem is that memory trace strength or familiarity is confounded with episodic memory. They both point to the same answers in the experiment. And so we need to unconfound those two explanations so that now one explanation makes one prediction and the other explanation makes another prediction. Then we can ask the animals to tell us which prediction they actually use. So our strategy for that was to double the amount of time between the presentation of the items. We control how long it takes to give the items. We can measure that for every experimenter, for every rat. And know exactly how long it takes for that animal to go from item 4 to item 3 to item 2 to item 1 to the test. And it's always at the end of the list. So that's the part we're focusing on. Okay, so now we double the amount of time between the events so that a second last item in the ordinal sense has the typical amount of time of a fourth last item. And then we give them a memory assessment with the correct fourth last item, and with this foil that has the memory trace strength of a typical fourth last item. And we ask the animals to tell us which cognitive strategy are they using. Are they judging memory trace strength? If they've been doing that all the way along, when we give them one of these tests, they should be fooled by the foil. It should be a very attractive option. It's the wrong choice, so we code that as an incorrect choice. So if they're using this non-episodic memory solution, their behavior should be below chance. If they're using the episodic memory solution, they're going to get the right answer, and the correct answer is going to be above chance. And so it's a really potent dissociation. We had the problem before that these two ideas are confounded, but now we have a testing ground where they're unconfounded, and we can ask, do the animals perform above chance, supporting episodic memory, or do they perform below chance, non-episodic memory? The rats were above chance, and so we conclude that they're using episodic memory. So it's a bit of a long, complicated story. We actually did, that's really just two experiments. We did five experiments in this paper. The first author of the paper is a graduate student in the lab. Her name is Danielle Painos-Brown. And we published it in the journal called Current Biology in 2018. The other experiments focused on more of the things that you were asking about at the beginning of our discussion about different aspects of how people define memory. So here I'll mention that episodic memory is an aspect of long-term memory. It should survive a relatively long delay. So we gave them a big long list of items, and instead of immediately asking them second last or fourth last, we waited for a delay. I think we waited up to 45 minutes in this experiment, which is a very long delay. It's clearly long-term memory. And they were excellent. They were just as good after 0 minutes of delay as they were after 45 minutes of delay. Another thing that we do with our, as I was saying before, I remember all the things I did this morning before I got into my office. I remember the things I was doing in my office. And later in the evening, I'll hopefully remember some of the things that I did at the end of the day. So this is sort of natural stuff for episodic memory, which is to say that we don't displace all of our old episodic memories when something new happens to us. There are lots of places where we forget stuff. Forgetting is a big aspect of memory. But there are at least some situations where I remember the first set of things that happened to me, the second set of things that happened to me, and so on throughout the day. And then you can ask me about my memory, and I'll report accurately. So we gave the animals an experiment like that. We gave them a big long list of items. And then we gave them a potentially interfering task. We moved them to yet another distinctive context where we gave them a new old recognition memory problem. So this is another type of memory. It's not episodic memory. And it just requires that they remember this. Have you seen it? Yes or no? And so it was an odor, so we know that they smelled the odor, and there's a memory component, so we can document that they actually remember the odor. And then we go back and ask them about the list, and the animals were just as good at answering questions about the list when they had interference and when they had no interference. Another key aspect of episodic memory is there's a lot of evidence that the hippocampus is a site in the brain that is a major processing center for episodic memory. So in the last installment in this series of studies, we used the chemogenetics technique called DREDS to temporarily inactivate the hippocampus. DREDS stands for designer receptors exclusively activated by designer drugs. And so this involves transfecting in a site of our choice, which was the hippocampus, receptors that don't exist in nature. They're just nowhere else in nature, but we can put them in the hippocampus by transfecting a virus that carries these receptors. The animals are healthy and recover, and if you wait the appointed time, the receptors are expressed in the place where you've infused them. Then you give them the designer drug that activates these receptors, and the technology that we used was one that specifically targets neurons, and it specifically inhibits the activity of neurons. So after doing the surgeries and waiting the appointed times, the animals are now in a situation where if we give them the drug, we can temporarily inhibit neurons in the hippocampus. And if we give them a vehicle solution, we would expect that we're not inhibiting the neurons in the hippocampus. So the neuroanatomical hypothesis is that if this is really episodic memory, you should need an intact functioning hippocampus to solve this problem. And so we tested that by temporarily inactivating the hippocampus, which lowered their ability to replay episodic memories, consistent with the notion that indeed it is episodic memory.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so that's all very interesting. Let me ask you now, the fact that we as humans are able to report our memories, do you think that in terms of memory research, that in any way helps researchers understanding better how memory works, or perhaps that because we have all sorts of issues like forgetting things and rewriting memories and things like that, that the fact that we are able to report our memories might even be a confounding factor in memory studies?
Right. So an aspect of that question in the case of episodic memory focuses on subjective experiences. So one of the reasons why investigating episodic memory in non-humans is that for a long time, the people who've developed these ideas in human cognition held the view that episodic memory involves subjective experiences, that you can translate yourself through time to re-experience aspects of the past, that you have a conscious sense about the positioning in time. So these are the subjective aspects of episodic memory. And indeed, with people, I can just ask you about your subjective experiences, and you might be able to report answers about that. In the case of non-humans, we can ask them about the contents of their memories, but we can't really ask them about their subjective experiences. I'll come back to my example of Alzheimer's disease. So the idea of developing these animal models of memory is that they can be applied to understand what's going on in diseases of human memory. What's debilitating for that grandmother who's suffering from Alzheimer's disease is the loss of the content, right? That she doesn't remember when you visited last, you talked about all the interesting things that are going on in your life. What's debilitating is the content, not the subjective experiences. I mean, eventually, people with deep dementia have all sorts of problems with subjective experiences as well, but that's at a much later state. The decline in episodic memory occurs rather early, and there the hope is that you could intervene and develop therapies that might help them when it hasn't been developing for too long. So in this context, I'll mention that a lot of the work that's going on in the lab now uses genetic models of Alzheimer's disease. So these are rats that have been developed to carry some of the genes associated with risk for Alzheimer's disease. I'll give you an example about one of them. We're using a model called humanized ApoE for knock-in rats. So ApoE stands for apolipoprotein E. And you can get genetic testing for this. It comes in different alleles. If you have the E4 allele, you're at very high risk for Alzheimer's disease. So these rats have the human E4 allele inserted, replacing the rat ApoE. And the idea is that if we're really studying episodic memory, then we should be able to look at their episodic memory function as the animals age and develop markers of neuropathology associated with Alzheimer's disease. So when Alzheimer's is a disease of aging, when the animals are young, we expect that they will be in an intact state, which is actually really essential because I just described an experiment that has lots of crazy rules that they need to learn. They need to be in top form when they're young, which is when we train them about those rules. And then we age them in the lab. And as they get old, we make the prediction that they're going to develop a decline in episodic memory in association with the development of markers of neuropathology of Alzheimer's disease. So, you know, all of that focuses on the content of episodic memories. If you ask me about what the animals are experiencing subjectively, I'd say I have no idea. I have no way to design an experiment to test it. But it doesn't concern me, because the goal here is to, if we can show a decline in episodic memory associated with the development of Alzheimer's neuropathology, is of course this becomes a testing ground for developing novel therapeutics that can help Alzheimer's patients with the content of episodic memories.
Mm-hmm. So what the animals or people experience consciously, it's not that important, right?
Well, it's important in the sense that it's an interesting aspect of human cognition. It's an aspect that is not readily tested in non-human animals.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So, you know, if you want to test that, work with human subjects.
Exactly. So, and even putting aside the subjective aspect of it, yes, is it easy or hard to establish a biological continuity between non-human models and humans? And I mean, to what extent can we extrapolate from non-human animals to humans?
So this is, of course, why, from my perspective, it's critically important to be really convinced that it's episodic memory. So I'll mention, in the case of preclinical models of Alzheimer's disease, most of this historically has been developed in mice, because the technology was more easily deployed with mice. They're smaller, they don't live as long, they reproduce quickly. And so all these genetic tools were initially developed in mice. Fortunately, the gene editing technology has advanced so that now it's quite feasible to develop these models in other animals, and increasingly they're becoming available in rats, which is great for me, because we can get rats to do these complicated experiments. Mice, you can do certain experiments with them, but you really couldn't get them to do the experiments we get rats to do. So the reason why I mention that is there's a huge problem of translational failure. So it seems like every month or so you hear a news report about some big pharma company that is closing down a clinical trial for an Alzheimer's drug. And the thing that I'll emphasize about that is, anytime that somebody's doing a clinical trial with patients, long before they ever worked with human participants, it was done with non-human animals. And in the case of Alzheimer's, it was done with mice. So there's a huge gap. It seems promising when tested with the mice, and then you test it with the people, and it fails. Now, I will say, there's a huge problem for the field, and it's going to take a lot of people with a lot of different skill sets to solve that translational problem. The contention that I make is that once the field has solved that really big challenge about translational failure, we had better have a way to assess episodic memory function in the animals, because it would be a real shame to go through all of that sort of substantial improvement and then test what's typically tested with mice, is spatial memory. There's nothing wrong with studying spatial memory. And indeed, in late stages of Alzheimer's disease, Alzheimer's patients have problems remembering where in their home. But it's the episodic memory function that is debilitating, and that comes at a much earlier stage in the progression of the disease. So we need to have a way to assess episodic memory function in the animals. And that's why, as I mentioned earlier, we think of this as converging lines of evidence. That, you know, I just told you about a fairly complicated experiment. It has some strengths and weaknesses. But if we have a completely different way to study episodic memory, we come up with the same conclusion that the animals have episodic memory, it'll have strengths and weaknesses, but they're somewhat different. We do this 6, 7, 8 times. Eventually, you get convinced that they probably have episodic memory. And so that's a long way from going from what people typically do, say, with mice and Alzheimer's disease. They study one thing like spatial navigation, and then they say, well, maybe they used episodic memory. And there's really no reason to believe that the animals were using episodic memory if you haven't ruled out all the non-episodic memory solutions. And I just mentioned spatial cognition. There's a spatial cognition solution. Mm-hmm. Now, we use spatial cognition too because rats are really adept with spatial navigation, and we can graft on the somewhat complicated rules of the game, which, by the way, those would be thought of as semantic memories, that the animals have learned the rules of the game. And then we can try to pinpoint, is there evidence that the animals also have episodic memory?
Mm-hmm. So do the animal models that you study also have prospective memory? I mean, do they in any way also are able to think about the future and plan for the future? And how do you get to know about that?
Yeah. I'm really interested in that topic. So what people often say about the evolution of memory, say, well, why did episodic memory evolve? It probably wasn't so that we could ruminate about the past. It was so that we could use our memories about the events in the past to better prepare us for the future. So there's a continuum there, and it takes rather different types of experiments to get at the future-oriented aspects of episodic memory, or what people call mental time travel, as opposed to the retrospective aspects, which are the contents of old memories. So that's a challenging problem. We're interested in it. We're doing some experiments on it now, but we don't have results in. I will tell you about one approach that we've developed on developing an animal model of prospective memory. So prospective memory is forming a representation to do something in the future, but it's not time yet to do it. You want to wait until the appropriate time to do it in the future. So I might need to get milk on my way home today, but I'm not sitting in my office all day long thinking about getting milk. Hopefully, when I drive by the store later, I'll remember that I had intended to get milk, and I might go in and buy some. So how would we test that in non-humans? The hallmark feature of prospective memory is that it saps attentional resources. If I really was sitting in my office all day long thinking about needing to buy groceries at the end of the day, I wouldn't be able to allocate as much of my cognitive resources to the things that I'm doing now that are ongoing. So an example of that that I like is some years ago, I used to pick my kids up from daycare across campus. And if somebody came into my office right before I needed to leave to go get my kids, this is a bad time to talk to me. I'm thinking about, I got to get across campus, I've got traffic, I got to grab my gear and bring it with me. And, you know, if I'm not there, they aren't going to put my kids out on the street, but they charge by the minute, and if you keep doing it, they kick your kids out of the daycare. So, you know, the purpose of that story is to animate the idea that in the morning, if you came to my office and wanted to talk to me, I'm not distracted by these future events, but if you came to me just minutes before I need to leave, I'm very distracted. So this is a hallmark feature of prospective memory, is that there's some competition for limited resources. And if you're just engaging in ongoing cognitive activity, you're going to be at your excellent high level of performance. But if you are at the moment also retrieving a prospective memory, you're going to have your suffer. Because now you have this competition between your ongoing cognitive activity and this retrieved prospective memory. That is very tractable to tested animals. I can't ask them about the future, but I can give them a sensitive measure of their cognitive performance, their ongoing performance. We gave them a duration discrimination experiment. They're making judgments about short and long durations. Rats are very good at this. They can learn it quite quickly. And at some point, we gave them a warning signal that told them that there's going to be something happening in the future. Not now, but sometime in the future. What future event could be important to the animal? For a hungry animal, nothing like a big pile of food. So we gave them access to basically a mini meal. They got hundreds of pellets. Instead of, you know, one or two little pellets, it was raining pellets. They got hundreds of pellets, over 200. And, of course, that's something where they might now orient their cognitive resources to the future event rather than the current event. So the prediction is that at the time that we warn them about this future event, they're going to have a hit on their ongoing task cognitive performance. They start off excellent, and if we give the event, their performance drops down. If we take that event away, their performance goes up, and we give it to them again, and their performance goes down, which sort of highlights that this is event-driven, on demand. If they are induced to retrieve their prospective memory about the future meal, their ongoing task performance suffers, and at other times their ongoing task performance is excellent. So we've done this with regular young rats. One of the interests about prospective memory is in people, prospective memory declines with age. There's some thought that it might be an early predictor of later Alzheimer's disease. So we did a developmental study where we started with young rats, and then we aged them in the lab and tested them when they were old. And not surprisingly, the young rats were like other rats that we had used. They showed robust prospective memory. And at an aged time point, which for the rat, 2 years is very old for a rat, they lost their ability to do prospective memory. Mm-hmm. So this is a concern for people in aging, because all the things that we have to do for taking care of ourselves are deeply embedded in prospective memory. I have to remember to turn the stove off before I leave the kitchen. I have to remember to take my medicine with dinner. I have to remember to lock the door when I leave. And as we get older, we begin to have problems with our prospective memory. Mm-hmm.
So does that mean that other animals are also able to keep track of time?
Yeah. So I actually got started studying timing in animals. There's a big literature on how animals keep track of time. And so I've always been interested in time. I will say that the types of models that are used for explaining how people and animals keep track of time are sometimes quite different from the mental time travel notion. The one that I'm most particularly interested in is the possibility that the animals have internal oscillators that allow them to have something like a calendar date system for time. So for people with language, we have a very rich calendar date system. I remember something happened on Tuesday, or that it was in January, or that it was last summer. And for the rats, the time of day that is most tractable is time of day. So a circadian representation of time, the morning versus the afternoon.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so another very interesting topic of your work has to do with metacognition, because I mean, it is even harder to understand how we can know that other animals, because they can't talk, they can't report those things to us, that they are able to think about thinking or knowing what they know or something like that. So how do you go about studying those sorts of things in non-human animals?
Right. So metacognition is a big controversial topic in testing with non-human animals. I got involved in it some years ago. Previous work had been done with monkeys. It was sort of a gold standard of how you would establish evidence for metacognition in a non-human. We adapted it for rats, and we published a paper that was called Metacognition in the Rat. One of the things that that did was sort of lead people to think very carefully about non-metacognition explanations, and people came up with non-metacognition models that, in my view, can explain pretty much all of the data in non-human animals to suggest metacognition. So the problem here, I'll try to say that a little more clearly, the problem here is non-metacognition explanations can produce putative metacognition data, in which case we should be really careful before concluding that it's episodic memory. But I'll give you a sense about the metacognition explanation. The example that I'll give you is about students who are in my courses. I do the typical traditional type of exam. When students come in to take the exam, I hand out an exam book. I've got all the questions. They have to come up with the answers. And how many questions they get right is going to determine their grade. Well, wouldn't it be nice if instead of that traditional exam, I gave them the following non-traditional exam? Every time they look at an item on the exam, they get to decide, do they want to be evaluated on this item or not? And if they know that they don't know the answer, they can selectively skip the answers that would bring down their performance. And that's why I say, wouldn't it be nice for my students, because they have some insight into their knowledge. I think many of us will have had this experience. You turn over the exam questions and you have that sinking feeling that you're not going to do well on this exam, or you feel good that you're going to do just fine. So this was the strategy that was developed in monkeys and that we adapted for rats. Basically, it allows the animal to use a response in the experimental preparation where they can decline to take a test or elect to take a test. And the key prediction is, as you particularly make the problems harder, there should be a big gap between your accuracy when you are forced to take every single question or when you elect to take a subset of the questions. If you're able to spot the questions that you're going to do badly at, especially the hardest ones, those don't go into the estimate of accuracy when you decline to take the test. Whereas if it's a forced test, you have to take every single test question and you can't skip the ones that you would have done poorly on. So that's the metacognition story. I effectively switch sides in this debate. I'm quite willing to switch again if somebody comes up with a different experimental preparation. But with the experimental preparation that I described to you, a non-metacognition explanation makes the same prediction. So I'm a bit skeptical about metacognition. I think of it as that whole package of explanations that they have: working memory and reference memory, and long-term memory and short-term memory, episodic memory, executive function. They have all these things plus metacognition versus all these things without metacognition. And I think that in principle that can be answered, but I think that the current tests that we and others have used is not adequate to answer the question. I will say I'm a bit of a minority view on that. A lot of people are increasingly convinced that lots of animals do have metacognition, but like I said, the strategy has to be you have all these things plus metacognition or not, and if you have a very specific model that takes these things and doesn't add metacognition, but it produces this divergence in accuracy that I was talking about before, then I don't think that divergence in accuracy is pinpointed into the metacognition.
Oh, that's very interesting. I would have thought that perhaps it would be the inverse situation and that most people would be skeptical about metacognition in other animals, but most people think that it exists.
Well, there are groups that think that it exists, and there are people who are skeptical. This is a long-going debate. Long before my entry into it, There had been lots of reservations about simple learning explanations that could produce metacognition. The description that I gave you about accuracy divergence, I think was thought to be one that simple explanations couldn't also explain. And I think that that has changed with both.
Okay, so just one last question. In your work, are you also interested in trying to discover an evolutionary rationale for how and for what functions did the several different subtypes of memory evolve in other animals and also in humans? Are you interested in knowing that as well or not?
So the perspective that I'll describe on that is when you test these things in rats, let me back up. Most people would think, well, if something has evolved in human cognition, that we should test our nearest descendants, non-human primates, perhaps chimpanzees, that's the place where we might find similar cognitive processes. I sort of think it's fun to turn that on its head by working with very distantly evolved animals like rats. Because if you think you need a primate brain to have some cognitive capacity, it seems to me that the only way to test that is to work with a non-primate brain and see if you can come up with that capacity or not. And so that's sort of the strategy that we have. When we find evidence, say, of metacognition or episodic memory or retrieval practice or prospective memory or any type of cognitive capacity that you might investigate, we have a lot of those that we find in rats, which suggests that you don't need to be closely related to humans to have those types of capacities. An empirical question, I suspect that there are lots, I'll say going back to episodic memory, I think there are lots of different elements of episodic memory, and maybe we have some elements of episodic memory and not other elements. That's why we need lots of different approaches to test to see in each of those different elements, do we find evidence or not? And because we've done sort of systematic testing of that, this is my view, there's better evidence that rats have episodic memory than non-human primates. Not that there's reservations about the non-human primates, but there's just a lot more that's been done with rats. Mm-hmm. So, you know, if you come back to, you mentioned language before or subjective experiences before, there's a strong intuition amongst people who think about human cognition that everything that we experience is linguistically based, that these types of capacities can't happen outside of the linguistic context. And of course, that's put to the test when you work with any non-human animal to see if animals have this despite the absence of language. And so it suggests that these types of capacities that we work with in a linguistic sense are probably much older in the evolutionary time scale and that they've evolved for rather different reasons.
And not only to test if those same sort of capacities can occur in a non-linguistic setting, let's say, but also outside of consciousness, right? Because, I mean, some of those capacities could operate the same way without the animal having conscious access to what's happening.
Yeah, I agree in the sense that I have no way to know if the animals are having a conscious experience, yes or no, and it's not profitably investigated in the types of preparations that we use for memory. But it's an interesting question.
Mm-hmm. Right. Okay, so Dr. Crystal, before we go, would you like to tell people what might be some of the best places on the internet for them to find your work?
So we have a bunch of papers that were published in the journal called Current Biology. And probably have about 10 empirical papers that are showing these novel animal models of episodic memory. I think they, a lot of places you can get access to the full article because the way funding works in the United States, that after a limited period, publishers have to make the text versions available to anyone without any paywall in the way.
Hi there, thank you for coming to my channel and for watching this interview until the end. As you might have noticed, I've been putting out regular interviews with academics and intellectuals from a variety of fields. So to keep the channel sustainable, I would like to ask you to please visit my Patreon page and to consider making a pledge there. Otherwise, I also have a PayPal and Subscribestar. And if you like what I'm doing, please share it, leave a like, and hit the subscription button. I would also like to give a huge thank you to my patrons, Karen Litske, Anne Blanchett, Perelga Larsen, Lau Guerrero, Chantel Gelinas, Francis Ford, Hans Frederick Sunde, Brian Rivera, Lucas Stafiniak, Sergio Condreano, Janne Henninen, Ricardo Vladimiro, and Dr. Jerry Muller, Herbert Gintis, and Rutger Voss, and also my three producers, Izar Webb, Rosie, and Jim Frank. Thank you for all.